Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first stepfather, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Edric Show. I am your host, Edric Jerome. This is the place for intelligent conversation with interesting people. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button, ring that notification bell, and you'll get notified of the content I post each and every week. My guest is Dr. Saqib Qureshi, author of the new book, Being Muslim Today, Reclaiming the Faith from Orthodoxy and Islamophobia. Dr. Qureshi is a fellow at the London School of Economics and Political Science, and his work has been featured in the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Entrepreneur. He's also produced two films, including the 1996 BBC One documentary Al-Dawa, the first television documentary about the Muslim community in any Western country. Dr. Qureshi, thank you for your patience with our technical difficulties, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jerome. I'm pleased to be here. Thank you.
All right, let's get into it. So my question before we were interrupted, and I apologize to my audience, we had a brief technical situation. But my first question is, when did you first decide to write this book, and what caused you to want to write about a modernized perspective on being Muslim?
So 3-odd years ago, I'm sat in my Toronto home, 10 in the morning, on a Saturday morning, that is, watching the English Premier League soccer, as you call it in North America, football to us Brits. I'm just minding my own business. My 15-year-old son, who's a pretty smart kid, comes up to me, and he knows that I'm really interested in my game, so it's not a good idea to interrupt me, but he asks me, Papa, is Islam a violent religion? And my first kind of instant reaction, or maybe a reflex, was, look, you know what, I'm just watching the game. And then I had to slow motion think and look at him and wonder, what? And I realized that his question was a real question. He actually was asking me whether Islam was a violent religion. And I was in shock, because I was like, that's just insane. That's an insane question. And it didn't take me many seconds to figure out, yes, given the way the media in North America in particular, and particularly in the US, portray Islam and Muslims, and the way they focus on any acts of violence that Muslims commit and link it to their religious identity, I understand where this question is coming from. So I went into my library hoping to find a book which would be accessible, easy to read, but which was really rigorous, which was like a dead, honest, highly rigorous piece of literature which my son could engage and get his questions answered. And much to my astonishment, there wasn't anything. So the books written on Islam tended to be either propaganda, fellow Muslims trying to do all sorts of theatrics, and lacking any meaningful scholarship, or they are very hard to read, like they are MPhil, PhD, or above. And I'm thinking to myself, a 15-year-old can't hack that. And so that inspired me to write a book on Islam with my children in mind, They're now three teens that I have, but it obviously goes to a much wider audience. And the focus has been to understand or to compile and explain what serious academia is writing about Islam, its origins, its changes, what it's writing about Muslims, and put that all together in a reasonably enjoyable text. So it's the no-nonsense, highly backed up with evidence summary, I suppose, of some of the answers that academia, that rigorous scholarship is putting out there, but it's done in a way which people can read without needing a postgraduate degree behind them.
That's a great point because you're able to balance centuries of history with a consistent narrative that's able to connect, reshape, and offer new perspectives on thousands of years of historical texts, scholars, and philosophies. How were you able to get your arms around the tremendous research required for your book? And did it ever become overwhelming? Because I can imagine you had to do vigorous research on a wide variety of texts and scholarly writings.
So I was quite lucky in a way that I didn't end up having to do much primary research myself. I ended up going through all of the scholarship out there, the serious academia, reading that through, which in some cases is quite difficult, actually in most cases very difficult, and making sense of it and trying to put the jigsaw puzzles together to answer or to shed light on some of the key tensions and questions that younger people and non-Muslims ask of Islam. So, some of the topics that often come up associated with Islam are to do with gender, are to do with violence, are to do with human rights, And so I was like, okay, let's go start probing some of these key questions while we also try and make sense of what this faith is about, where it began, how it changed, what is the range of diversity in this faith? And using that to take on both Islamic orthodoxy, which is very predominant in Muslim majority countries, but also to take on Islamophobia, because an awful lot of Islamophobia, actually, the vast chunk of it is not a fear of Islam, which I think would be a legitimate angle to have, but it's a fear of a completely misconstructed and by and large, purposefully misconstructed interpretation of Islam. So you've got people who go out there. I've noticed in social media they make claims about Islam, and I'm 50 years old. I've lived in three continents. Half of my friends are Muslims, and I look at those claims that are made about Islam, and I'm thinking, I don't know where you get your knowledge about Muslims or Islam from, but I can't relate to this. I just simply can't relate. And so my book is, in some measure, it's saying, look, this is what we know about the faith from the 7th century onwards. This is what we don't know. We don't know many things. And here's some kind of inklings on some bits and pieces. But there's an awful lot there that challenges both orthodoxy and the Islamophobia community.
You mentioned challenges, and one of the things I admire about your work is that there's an air of fearlessness, meaning you are willing to engage in very difficult and sensitive topics that are emotional in its content. So, one of the areas that you dive into is you talk about some of the misconceptions about the Prophet Muhammad, and how can you share light with my audience about how can addressing those misconceptions help lead to maybe reducing Islamophobia?
So one very interesting data point is that the last prophet, Muhammad, and he was the last prophet. He wasn't the first, the only, the greatest, the be all, but the last. There's Jesus, Moses, David, and a few others. But he's the last prophet. And during his prophethood of 22 years, he led the Muslim community in something of a, you couldn't call it a country, but certainly a polity of sorts. Now, what records we have are sparse. They are very sparse. But what records we have, for what they're worth, suggests that in his 22 years of rule, 1,000 people were killed in battles that he fought. Okay. And those 1,000 were on both sides. So, in aggregate, 1,000 deaths over a 22-year period. You compare that to Richard the Lionheart, who in one day killed 3,000 prisoners of war. So it's like we as Muslims are accused of being a violent faith, but the prophet who led a political community for 20 odd years was involved in 9 wars, battles, ending with 1,000 lost lives. I'm not saying that losing lives is a good and healthy thing, but Richard the Lionheart has a statue of himself on a horse in front of the British Parliament when he killed 3,000 people in a day. And so stuff like that, which was like, wait, you know what? Maybe we should just put the number out there. Let's put the statistic out there. Yes, we don't know for certain. We cannot be sure of our 7th century records, but the very limited evidence we have suggests this. And now is for everybody else who wants to know more about this issue to engage it. They can engage it and say, or somebody, better come up with an alternative headcount and demonstrate why that alternative headcount is one that we should run with, And so this is just one kind of illustrative example of, kind of going out there and just putting out the data and saying, okay, guys, how do you deal with this?
You offer several well thought out critiques of orthodoxy, and you examine its impact across the world to this day. What are some of the ways that orthodoxy needs to be challenged or reexamined? And more importantly, who needs to do that?
Oh man. So Islamic orthodoxy is a very powerful place. They tend to have remarkable control and authority in Muslim-majority countries. Not only that, but they very often have the ability to use physical force to clamp down on people who start questioning orthodoxy. This is not an unusual thing. And not just a Muslim thing, is actually very common in tribal pre-modern societies, of which most Muslim majority countries are part of. But there are Christian countries, for instance, in Africa, where if you challenge the dominant interpretation of Christianity, you are asking for trouble. Now, so you have that in Muslim majority countries when it comes to orthodoxy, And so challenging orthodoxy from within Muslim majority countries is dangerous. Challenging Christianity from some countries in Africa or South America is also a bit dangerous. Okay. And so who can take that challenge on is people, is Muslims of the West, because we enjoy the liberties, we enjoy the freedom of speech, we enjoy the ability to go around and critiquing and praising and challenging the prime minister or the president or whatever else without the fear of us being locked away, by and large. And so it's really, there's a huge responsibility on Muslims of the West to do that. And Muslims have been off the West for centuries. It's not like we kind of arrived in the UK 50 years ago. No, we've been here for centuries. Muslims have been in the US for centuries. They fought in the Civil War, So it's like this notion that we are somehow foreign is one that I push back immensely. And we see the imprint of Muslims in the West, left, right, and center. But the point is that I think there's a massive responsibility on people such as myself to go out there and say, look, this is what we can find. This is what we know. This is what we don't know. Apologies if it really offends you, but you've got to kind of just learn to live with that offense. I'm not saying that you are a nasty piece of work, or I'm not saying that you don't deserve to live. What I'm saying is that there is an interpretation of faith, which I have, which contradicts your interpretation of faith, and so be it.
Another area of where you dive in is you offer an analysis of the origins and of the Quran and how it's been used and how it's been interpreted. But bringing it up to today, how should the Quran be used to guide Muslims through their day-to-day lives in the 21st century?
So I think the important question that I want to tackle is what is the Quran? So And once I've explained it, I hope that some of your listeners can then make sense of how it might be applicable to today. The Quran is a compilation of transcribed messages given to the last prophet over the course of 23 years in the space-time context that he was in. Okay. Many of those messages are extremely specific to him, including reminding him when he was on the far side of the valley, dot dot dot. And you're wondering, that message can't be for me because I don't remember ever being on the far side of the valley. So how do you then deal with messages which were presented from, I mean, Muslims would say, God, to the last prophet, okay, and then later transcribed? This is an important thing. The message had its moment 1400 years ago, and then a few, and at some point later it was transcribed and then it was put together in a book. How do you then make sense of those messages if you don't have tone of message, you don't have context of message? And I mean, and I do mean context, because we don't even know which city the last prophet was in when he received certain messages. Forget who was sat next to him, what was said the moment before, whether it was a nice moment, whether there were angry people there. We have, for many, many messages, we have absolutely no context. We know we have no tone. How do you then make sense of these transcribed messages? And for people who are in the legal industry, they'll understand the limitations of transcription. It's like you've kind of taken the words out of the context in which they had meaning, and now you're trying to impose them left, right, and center. And so the Quran becomes a wonderful vehicle to be abused, because there are certain messages which, if you read out of context, or you have no context to read them out of, look remarkably harsh and nasty. But I do remind people that, look, this is a collection of transcribed messages which was then assembled. How do we make sense of this? It's not easy. It is hard. It is really hard. And I'm not entirely sure that running with an institutional approach to that answer makes sense. I actually don't like the institutionalizing of these interpretations, because I mean, how do I mean I
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 40 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And only for the month of January, earn up to $550 extra when you sell with The RealReal. That's right, up to $550 extra. Go to TheRealReal.com to get started. Earn up to $550 extra this month at TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
I can't see a solution to getting to the pure decontextualized focus of each message. At a high level, there are some themes that are very, very important to the Quran. So some of the high-level themes are worship God, do good, remember that you're accountable at the end of your life, avoid violence, avoid being nasty to other people, be kind to people who are less able or who have suffered more, or like widows and people who are sick. These are some of the core principles that come out again and again and again. It's like an, I don't want to say it's repeat play, but that is the overwhelming thrust. All of that around this notion that you must worship God and only God. And beyond that, taking the kind of micro statements of each message and kind of trying to manipulate it or make sense of it is not easy work. It's very hard.
I mean, those some of those are universal truths across religion, across orthodoxies. I mean, being nice to others, you see that in many, many, many texts across the world. But I do want to come back to there's an irony that you raise that you write about very well, I think, which is despite Islamophobia, there's a continuing impact of Islam on Western philosophies. And you write particularly about the influence of Ibn Khaldun. Can you speak a little bit about just how ironic it is that, you know, here we are in the West with Islamophobia, but at the same time, there's so much influence of Islam on our culture that we just don't see?
Yeah. So where do Americans think the dome in Congress came from? From a mosque, Syria. You know, simple as that. The dome in Congress is a representation of a mosque. European architects in the 17th, 18th, 19th century were perfectly willing and able to acknowledge the debt that was owed to Muslim architects of mosques. The dome, the church tower bell is simply a copy and paste of the minaret. The bell, in particular, is a replacement for the person in a mosque who announces the prayer times. Okay, and that's simply architecture. So onto philosophy, Ibn Khaldun, like you mentioned, huge impact on history, huge impact on economics, huge impact on sociology. You know, Ibn Sina, who's otherwise known as Avicenna in the West, was the most important physician for 400 years in Europe. His work dominated for four centuries. And at one point, he was the most important. Actually, he was the most important pre-modern philosopher in terms of impact on Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. You know, after Aristotle, who do we turn to first? It's Avicenna. You know, and so this kind of looking at Islam and Muslims as the other is intellectually bankrupt. You know, it's just completely popper kook. And it might, you know, it might serve its purpose to make, you know, to kind of stoke the fuel of xenophobia, but in reality, intellectually, it's completely bankrupt. You know? So, I thought it was very important for my son's generation, and then thereafter for people generally to be aware of some of these things so that they can think beyond the simpleton, you know, sound bites that a lot of the right-wing, conflict, xenophobic-centered media organizations like to push out there.
You talked about a little bit about it earlier, but I want to come back to this, the question of what role does gender equality play in reclaiming the faith from orthodoxy and Islamophobia?
Oh, yeah, this is a huge topic because I think one of the things that shocked me when I had done the research for the book, one of the things that really did shock me was the realization that the last prophet probably initiated one of the most aggressive gender revolutions and gender equality revolutions in the history of our species. I was like, no, that doesn't really stack up with my understanding, you know, my but it's very true. It's like he took women who were in many parts of the Arabian Peninsula an asset to be traded, and he put them, from what we can tell, as an absolute equality to men. Women and men are mentioned equally in the Quran the same number of times, which is kind of interesting because the document, you know, is a transcript of a 23-year period communication. So men and women are mentioned equal numbers of times. There is no gender role in the Quran. And a lot of the gender phobia that is thrown at Islam, not gender phobia, but the kind of the ridiculing of gender in Islam, that is what I learned with my research, was that it's just popper kook. Like, it literally is popper kook. Now, I'm not saying that Muslim communities have since embraced that gender equality. They have not. And frankly, I don't even think the US has. You still haven't had a female US president. We're one of the very few countries in the world right now to not have a US president who's sorry, to not have a president who's a woman. But there's no doubt that the Muslim world has regressed badly when it comes to gender equality. That being said, I'm already hearing, echoes of, well, Pakistan's had a prime minister who's a woman, so has Bangladesh, so has Indonesia, and so it's not a disaster, but it hasn't been great. But I think the biggest shock for me really was the realization that what limited evidence we have, and again, I don't want to make a huge mountain of that, but
Sure.
limited evidence, but it would suggest it's arguably one of the most powerful gender equality revolutions in the history of our species.
Despite your numerous examples of how Islamophobia and orthodoxy work together in modern society to negatively impact the global Muslim community, despite all that, you remain optimistic. How can this happen, given, and how can you remain optimistic, or how do you remain optimistic? Given how entrenched Islamophobia is in our politics, our media, and all the other places that you cite in your book.
I think my optimism comes from the realization that it is not going to be easy for anybody to hide what this religion is about and the curves and bends and twists and turns it's taken, and its very broad spectrum. It's not going to be easy to hide all of that. And so pocketing up Islam as a single ideology, and giving it the most nauseous spin on the planet might work very well in parts of the Republican Party in the US in particular. But for anybody who's remotely interested in the faith and kind of wants to actually tackle and engage and problem solve and look at and investigate and research, it's going to prove very hard to hold on to those nauseous, simplistic interpretations. It's going to prove very, very hard. And I think what the internet will enable is a growing spread of our knowledge about the religion. It will, people will begin to say, yeah, you know what? I didn't know that was the case, but I know it now because I got, a social media post which had a link to a particular document which, I just wasn't aware of. And so what I'm saying is, I think that there's enough. There's a critical mass of serious scholarship, which is now percolating slowly, and it's making it really hard for bigots to sustain themselves. Like, it's making it really, really hard, for that to happen. And I think that's my real cause of optimism. It's just it's like the knowledge is beginning to accumulate with the big enough mass, it's now beginning to get disseminated. More and more Muslim people are challenging orthodoxy and they're challenging the Islamophobes, like people who have Google on their iPads ready to go to fact check everything, which is like my three kids. If I tell them anything, like by definition, one of them has to have checked it on Google before I finish my sentence. Okay. And so this is an entire legion of people that just wants to continue to check. And like, okay. That's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful because then that forces, your Gen Z generation to go after material and challenge and question in a way that we've never had to do or face in the past. Like, my kids seriously question practically everything I say. And I think that's fantastic because they are part of a generation that isn't going to stand there accepting propaganda.
Well said. Well said. When you were starting this book and you were starting to get into it and really delving into these subjects, did anybody try to talk you out of going there for, as under caution? Because you even write about how some of the reactions are to books that are critical of Islam and things like that. So were you ever in a situation where someone said, maybe you want to pull back a little bit, or did that come up at all?
The overwhelming majority of Muslim friends and family of mine said the same thing. Be very careful what you write in that book. Be very careful because we do have a lunatic fringe. Okay, they're not that many of them. You don't know of them. They don't really come across our paths that often, but you've got to be very careful about them. And to that, I was like, you know what? If we don't start making a stand, we're dead and buried. We have got to learn to make this stand. I was recommended go write another book on strategy or go write another book on democracy, which had done quite well. And I was like, no. This has got to be done. We have got to put some markers out there. I'm not trying to sugarcoat the religion. I'm not trying to defend the religion. I'm not trying to sell the religion because there are parts of this of the religion, or at least the journey it's taken, on the which have not been amazing. But fundamentally, I'm more proud of being Muslim now, having written this book, than I was 3 years ago. So I said, and to top it off, I reminded everybody that every second sentence of what I intend to write will be backed with an academic level source note. This is so important. It's like I'm not just making this stuff up. I am giving you the underlying source for everything that I'm saying. If you want to challenge the underlying source, just go ahead, pick up the reference material. But I think I was very disappointed that so many people came up to me and said, just be very careful what you write, or do you really want to write this? Because if you write this, then you know what, the kind of lunatic fringe in our religion will go after you. Or even, you have the right-wing nutcases who'll go after you as well and accuse you of being an Islamist, whatever that is, or all sorts of stupid words. Like, you know what? Let me just write as dead honest an account as I possibly can. Okay. And if there are consequences, we'll figure the consequences. But I'm not going to write anything slanderous, or I'm not going to spin stuff. I'm not going to just make stuff up. Where we think we have a good basis of understanding, I'll say it. Where we think we don't have a good basis of understanding because the facts aren't coherent or the information simply isn't there, I'll say it. And if our community has a problem with that, then we have a problem with the community. We have to start looking a bit more inwards to challenge people who get excited, about views that are non-orthodox. So one of the great phrases that I've come across amongst Muslim people in the West is actually just generally is, be very careful of that. Be very, that sounds like very dangerous thinking. If you challenge orthodoxy, you will often hear people say, that's very dangerous thinking. Like, dude, what kind of perception of danger do you have? I mean, is God going to lose it with me because I have questioned something? It's like, I don't think things work that way, and nor should they work that way.
No, as I said in the opening, you are fearless in the subject matter you've tackled, and I think you've added to the conversation that needs to be had. And I appreciated while I was reading the book just the different perspective that it even gave me as someone who considers themselves to be open-minded and enlightened and welcoming of cultures. I learned quite a bit from your book, so I just want to thank you for having the courage to put this out there, because I think it's a good way to foster this conversation. So congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Jerome. Thank you very much. I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
Yeah, you're very welcome. You're very welcome. So if people want to get more information about you, or the book, or how can they get it, where can they go?
So I have a website, saqibqureshi.com, and I'm on LinkedIn, pretty active on Twitter as well. And the book is released 7th of May. So,
Today.
yeah, today is the release date, so I'm quite excited by that. But saqibqureshi.com is one way to connect. On Twitter, I'm there, and I'm also on LinkedIn.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Dr. Qureshi, I want to thank you so much for appearing on the EDGIC Show. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Jerome, wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. This has been another edition of the EDGIC Show. My guest has been Dr. Saqib Qureshi, author of the new book, Being Muslim Today: Reclaiming Faith from Orthodoxy and Islamophobia. It is released today. So go out and get a copy, read it for yourself, and make up your own mind, because it will give you a different perspective on things for both Muslims and non-Muslims. So again, doctor, thank you so much.
Very welcome. Really enjoyed it. Thanks, Jerome.
You're very welcome. This is the place for intelligent conversation with interesting people. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button, ring that notification bell, and you'll get notified when I post content each and every week. Again, my name is Edric Jerome, host of The Edric Show. Thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you on the next episode.